Okay.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Josh Bloom, ACSH Director of Chemical and Pharmaceutical Science. He earned his PhD in Organic Chemistry at the University of Virginia, followed by a postdoctoral training at the University of Pennsylvania. Most of you know him for his advocacy and for his writing, but before that, early in his career, he was a prolific researcher and inventor, having up to 25 patents and 35 academic papers. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Bloom.
Thank you, Jay. Pleasure to be here on a Saturday evening when I should be doing something else, but it's just fine. Don't you worry.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Let's begin really at the early phases of your career. You were in the pharmaceutical industry. You had mentioned that you have quite a few number of patents and academic papers. Talk a little bit about your experiences in those early years. How is it like working in the research field and publishing and patenting at such a prolific rate?
Well, I don't want to really, make this sound overblown, but the 25 patents is nothing. In the pharmaceutical industry, when you're doing drug discovery, which is what I did, mostly in the antiviral area, but also in some others, you have to patent every series of compounds, even though they're never going to see the light of day. And you do that just in case, or you do it in case somebody else comes up with an invention that may lay within the bounds of your patents, and then you force them to license things with you. So most patenting is defensive. Every now and then a drug comes out of a group, and one did come out of mine, called Tigacil, an antibiotic for resistant organisms. That one was important. Most of them are best forgotten. Academic papers, well, you need to write them. I wrote a bunch of them in grad school and just kept going. And they're not fun. They're just not fun to write, not fun to read. It's part of the job.
Interesting.
So, not to say that I'm not brilliant or anything, but these accomplishments are not, what they might sound like on a resume. Standard drug discovery background, which I did for 25 years.
Well, in that time, you must have gleaned a lot of experiences. I want to touch on a few points that you brought up, because I think that's important for the audience to understand. You mentioned, and kind of referencing your own language, traditional background for somebody in drug development and research. But you also talked about defensive strategies of patenting, which I think is very interesting that most people don't really understand. And when you're developing a concept and trying to patent it, an invention, most people don't understand that you have to go through things like a patent review, a claims analysis, a freedom to operate. And there's a lot of business strategy in that that most people may not be aware of, because when they think of patent, they think of brilliant invention, Thomas Edison and the light bulb. Can you talk a little bit from your perspective, maybe the business aspects of patenting and how that plays in the pharmaceutical world?
Let's say when you finish working on a series for a particular disease, and let's say I was HIV, which I was doing for a while, and it flopped because 95%+ of all discovery projects will never get to the drugstore, or maybe even more than that. It's a frustrating career if you're looking for instant results, like be a bond trader on Wall Street if you like. Want instant gratification. But it's still part of the job in that, let's say, that series of compounds I made to slow down the replication of HIV or hepatitis C, which I also worked on, or herpes. Let's say somebody finds that same compound is useful for cancer. It's in our patent, so we've got some protection, even though they want to use it for something else. So the two companies will then usually make a deal where they'll, split revenue or something along those lines. So It's to protect your own inventions and also to protect inventions that are not worthwhile that may become worthwhile to someone else at a later point. And that's impossible to know in advance.
Yeah. Not to play the cynic, but I know that many times the patent play and patent strategy is very important for many portfolio companies, many startup companies, just trying to create a very strong patent Rolodex. Do you see some patents being outwritten in certain claims being developed in a way just to kind of say, hey, well, in the future, we know something like this will happen. We can't invest the R&D into it, but if somebody else does, we'll be there to catch up on it.
Yep. Patents now have essentially an infinite number of compounds covered.
Yeah.
And the patent office, let me just back up a little bit. They're patent liaisons and patent attorneys that work on this. We simply list the compounds that are made and help come up with a generic structure to define them. At that point, we want nothing more to do with it, because if there's a worse job than constructing patents, I have never heard of it. Because it's tedious, it's full of details, and if you mess it up, then there's all kinds of trouble. So we take it to a certain point, and then the experts take over. Of course, when they're finishing up, the discoverers are in the room trying to make sure it's all done right. But generally, it's it's a fairly tedious process rather than an exciting one.
Yeah, understood.
I should also mention that a patent, in case your viewers don't know, a patent does not give you the right to sell anything. All it does is gives you the right to exclude others from using what you've invented. So a patent approval and an FDA application for new drug or whatever have nothing whatsoever to do with each other.
Is that when the freedom to operate would come in?
Keeps changing, because as computers have really taken over from drawing these generic structures, the numbers of potential compounds, 99.9% of which haven't even been made, they grow hugely. So there can be millions and millions of covered compounds in a patent for arthritis, let's say. And that's between the patent attorneys and the U.S. Patent Office. And I just want to hide under a desk when it comes to that stuff.
Fair enough. I think that's probably why you transitioned into a role that's more along the lines of public policy and patient advocacy, you could say.
Well, I didn't transition. I got transitioned.
Hmm. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I guess back in the 80s and the 90s, Pfizer started buying a lot of companies. Warner Lambert, Park Davis was one of the big ones. And it started to play out that when Pfizer bought you, it was a little like going to the doctor who says, "Eh, you know, there's a spot on your lung x-ray, but it's probably nothing." Well, it's not nothing, because if you get bought by Pfizer, it's time to start looking for another job immediately. So the company I was with for a long time was called Wyeth, and they bought us in 2009, and then they let everybody go, with a few exceptions, by 2010, including myself. And just by a freak of nature and a strange bunch of coincidences, I landed up at ACSH, which is really well suited for what I do, because I've got the chemistry and the pharmacology and the medical background to write about a broad bunch of topics. And it gives me a special set of skills that certainly no journalists have. Most people don't have. They even go through a quarter of a century of drug discovery, which is not just chemistry, by the way. You use chemistry to make molecules. You use molecular modeling to design them. You work with people in pharmacological sciences to see if they're going to be possible drugs, or whether they're going to decompose in 5 seconds in your stomach, whether they're going to have toxicity, whether they interact with other drugs. So this is the whole business of pharmacokinetics and pharmacology, which I wasn't formally trained as. I was trained as a synthetic organic chemist who just makes molecules. And when you turn that into medicinal chemistry, you pile a whole layer of stuff on top of it, very valuable stuff. And that's where the biology, the biochemistry, the molecular biology, molecular modeling, unfortunately, patent writing, and a lot of the medicine comes in. Because if I'm working in the antiviral area, I've got to know the medicine cold, or I'm not doing the job properly.
Nice. I want to take you back a few minutes when you talked about your writing relative to a health journalist, and you mentioned your perspective is a little bit different. There's a couple of articles that I want to go into a little bit detail that you wrote recently, but before we delve into the details, maybe at a more general level, how is your writing unique compared to a health journalist, and what nuances do you pick up on that may be missed?
Two primary ways. One is that they don't have anything close to my training, because they didn't get PhDs in chemistry and they didn't work 25 years in the drug company. So I'm an expert and a journalist. So I give interviews to other journalists. So it's kind of a fortuitous combination of skills. And the other thing is I've got what might be described as a moderately poor attitude when it comes to certain things. I tend to say what's on my mind, which sometimes works out, sometimes doesn't. I think I'm hilariously funny, and my wife thinks I'm an idiot. Don't you laugh? So, but I've found that using humor, which kind of comes naturally, combine it with science and medicine and teaching, it's a very effective tool, and a lot of people really enjoy reading it just to see what bizarre thing I'm going to talk about next. Mm-hmm. But not just that. I mean, in a chemistry lesson, I'll make it amusing, and people will read it who would never normally read stuff like that. So I guess I'm fantastic if like you're listening.
Fair enough. How do you decide what to write about? Now, obviously, there's a certain scope of topics by which you are the subject matter expert in, but within that range, there's a myriad of new drugs being developed, new health policy issues. What triggers a particular topic to then become writing worthy in your mind?
That's one of the few stressful things about my job, because sometimes I got 10 ideas ready to go and I'll take on 5 of them. And sometimes I can't think of a single thing to write about. But where they come from, a lot of them will come from medical news or science news, and I'll take something or other and explain it in a way that people will be able to understand it. Sometimes I give what I call the dreaded chemistry lesson from hell, which is a chemistry lesson with 2 guys from hell who are the moderators of it. And I make it as amusing as possible, but it's a chemistry lesson. So, there's a certain group of psychopaths who enjoy that particular thing. But it comes from all over the place. People send me papers. I get way too many science and medical feeds across into my email every day. Can't even keep up with them. But every now or I'll see something on the news, or people will send me ideas for articles. And then the light bulb goes off. It says, yeah, something I can write about. But it comes from all over the place. And sometimes it doesn't come at all. And, you know, it's it's a little stressful. And we have a small group. There are only three senior writers. And if I'm not writing, it puts a lot of burden on the other two, who I'm extraordinarily fond of and just could not have more respect for. That's Chuck Dinnerstein and Henry Miller. And they're both fantastic. And we all, you know, we all just really like each other. So nobody wants to put the other person in a position where they have to write five articles in a week. Yeah. So the problem is I'll wake up at 4 a.m. and look at my phone just to see if there's anything that, you know, new breaking news that I could write something about or an idea. So, you know, none of us work the 40-hour week. We work whatever it takes to get the articles done.
Yeah.
But the hours can be odd. But still, I mean, I wouldn't trade it for anything. It's the best job in the world.
Yeah.
I could write whatever I want, however I want it. And except for one or two death threats over the years, it's gone pretty well.
Nice.
No, I'm not kidding.
Wow. There are quite a few topics that you write about that are certainly polarizing. I hope nothing to the level of death threats, but one of the articles that we share a common interest in is the articles that you write about related to the DEA. And there's a recent article you had written, and I'm writing the title, and I will include it in the comment section below. DEA chasing its tail again, this time is synthetic cannabinoids. And this was an interesting article because you highlight the ineffectiveness of prohibitionist DEA policies. Where do you develop that perspective? Is it something that you picked up through your observations of health policy, or is there something in the science or in the nuances that you picked up in your formal training that informs that perspective?
It's some of both, or all three, really. Some of these, what we're really talking about is new drugs. And sometimes they're 50-year-old drugs, but they're new in the sense that they're just starting to show up in our street drug supply. Some of these drugs started coming into the country and being mixed in with fentanyl way after fentanyl ever hit the country in 2013. So a couple of notable ones, one is called xylazine, also called Trank, which is, I think it's an animal tranquilizer. But if you inject it, it causes necrosis in the area of the injection because it restricts blood flow. And I've seen photos of, like, looks like science fiction movie where chunks of people's flesh just rot away from this. And there's no antidote for it like there is for the opioids with naloxone. And another scarier one is called nitazenes, mm-hmm. which they've never even been used as drugs except for nefarious purposes. These have never been approved for anything. And these things, some of these are 10 times more potent than fentanyl. And fentanyl set the standard where a little pinch could be fatal. And now we're talking about an amount you can't even see that can be fatal. So yeah. I think there's only about 2% of samples test positive for this type of class of compounds. But of course, the more the DEA cracks down on fentanyl and the chemicals used to make it, the more of these other things we're going to see.
Yeah.
And it's been called whack-a-mole. It's been called trying to juggle Jell-O, because it's impossible. But the interesting thing is it started with the patents, and there's a strong connection to what I used to do in constructing patents, and it's what the DEA is doing to try and ban compounds. So right now they have a list of fentanyl analogs that are illegal and fentanyl chemicals that are on a Schedule I list. And then I saw what we call a generic structure, which is a skeleton of fentanyl where you put undefined groups or carbon atoms or chlorines. And it's written just like a patent because it covers everything, whether there's a chlorine there or carbon there or hydrogen there. So that will then make fentanyl analogs that haven't even been imagined yet, let alone made, illegal, because they're part of a patent-like, it's really identical to a patent-like strategy for trying to ban every possible fentanyl.
Wow.
The trouble with that is, just like with every other patent, you can always beat it. There's always around a way around it. And if fentanyl gets too difficult to make and import, then the nitazenes will show up. And right now there's just a list of a few of them. And they just added six to the list. And if you take a look at the structures, as an organic chemist, I could think of 100 right off the bat that I could make, all of which would be active opioids.
Hmm.
So Dr. Jeff Singer of the Cato Institute and I, we're frequent writing partners. And one of the things Jeff stresses is the iron law of prohibition, which states that the harder the enforcement, the worse the drugs.
Yeah.
And this has been dead on ever since those idiots at the CDC started restricting the amount of legitimate and much safer pain drugs. Everything that comes is worse. So they went after pills. Then came heroin. About 2010, there was a huge uptick in heroin. Then seeing a heroin market, Chinese chemists started making fentanyl. So that's in. That's all over the place, killing people. And then next was xylazines, and next were nitazenes. And you can see that if there were ever an example of the proper use of the expression chasing its tail, this is what the DEA is doing, because they keep loading up lists with one drug after another, only to have 50 more appear the next day.
Mm-hmm. Why aren't they changing their policy? And I know that this is kind of a Pandora's box of a question, but, you know, given that we only have one day for a conversation, you know their policy is flawed. Other subject matter experts know the strategy is flawed, yet it never really seems to change. What are you seeing that's preventing a much-needed change in their approach?
Do you got a little bell you can ring? Because it's cynic time.
Yeah.
Okay. So your statement that the policy doesn't work, I would have to ask you, for whom doesn't it work?
Hmm.
It works very well for the FDA. I'm sorry, for the DEA, because they have continued targets to go after. It works very well for the anti-opioid people who don't want you to take a Percocet or whatever, because the death toll keeps going up as all these new drugs can come flying in. And then you have, I don't even want to mention his name. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
People who somehow deny that the more we cut legitimate prescriptions, the more people die. And that is clear cut evidence. There's an enormous inverse relationship between prescription numbers and deaths. It looks like an X. One goes down, the other comes up. And the prop people who I won't mention on an empty stomach or a full stomach, they have come up with some twisted logic, if you can even call it that, about why the fentanyl deaths and all these other ones that are starting are not because they instrumented the cut in prescription opioids. Well, that's the biggest pile of, I don't know, whatever your rating is for this show, I'll just leave it at that I've ever heard, because it's so obvious, not just from the data, but from the people I talk to and that write to me all the time. They are out of luck because the DEA is going after all the doctors, something you know very well about.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
They're terrified to write even for tramadol. And people coming out of dental procedures or surgery with Advil, they suffer. And the worst suffering, of course, are the millions of, let's call them legacy pain patients who've been taking real pain drugs for a long time. And to have a government agency led by a very unscrupulous group of doctors, and I'll get into that if you want later, to have them rip drugs out of the hands of people who need them is disgusting. And I get, let's say, a half dozen requests for help with suicide, maybe even more, every year. And I talk to all of them, and there's only so much I can do. I can't get them drugs, nor can I give them advice on how to take their own lives, which I could do, and it would work. And I'm actually very upset because one woman who I got friendly with, and she kind of helped me with my writing, she was talking about going back out into the street last week because she might as well go down in a blaze of glory rather than just be suffering all the time. And I keep calling and texting, and I'm not a word from her.
Wow.
So I think she could be another statistic. This was a person that I got to know pretty well over the last year or two. And it's just, it's very sad, and it's infuriating too.
Yeah. Before I get into the nuances of the administrative state, I want to come back to something you had mentioned earlier, where you describe yourself as a health journalist, but also as a subject matter expert. You're a primary source. People reference you all the time, and you write. But it seems like it's not picking up at the pace that it should. Maybe there's some pace, but not picking up at the pace that it should, given the anecdote you had just referenced and so many other patients. What is it about the journalism world that has such, I would say, maybe anathema to looking at this perspective as you're describing it?
Because the reality of this is there's no easy solution to any of this. So that enables the DEA and its, its agents and its administration to keep doing what they're doing and keep their jobs and their power. It enables groups like PROP, which has members that are making small fortunes that I will never see, to testify against drug companies as experts. When, from what I've seen, these people are about as expert in this matter as, like, my toaster is. I think they've proclaimed themselves to be experts, but what I read, and this is just opinion, of course, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. Or are just pretending and are just saying things to further their own cause. So you've got government bureaucracy You've got, let's just say, maybe corruption, and you've also got political realities. You tell me what's going to happen to somebody running for the Senate or the Congress who says, no, we need more opioid drugs. In today's soundbite world, what do you think is going to happen to them? So nobody is going to come out and say, no, this is no good. So really everything's working against it. And I think that's where we're seeing such a slow progress. But in state legislation later, yes, state legislations and in some court decisions, there are signs that it's starting to turn around. And I'm sure you're more aware of these things than I am, but very slowly. And I'm hearing dribs and drabs about class action lawsuit against the DEA for depriving patients of their what medicines they need. And by the way, whoever told the DEA they were allowed to tell patients what medicines they need, or doctors how much they're allowed to prescribe, or pharmacies how much they're allowed to sell, or distributors how much they're allowed to distribute. Who the hell are these guys to be telling us this? They're out of control is what they are. And you've got a bureaucracy that's out of control, and you know what happens when that happens. So everything is working against a substantial reform, except my friends and colleagues who are just hammering constantly at the perpetrators of this, let's just call it a fraud, that these pills are now what are responsible for what's killing American people in huge numbers. When in fact, and I've been on radio shows when I've said this, kind of tongue in cheek, if you put a giant bucket of Vicodin pills like on street corners in cities, I bet that the death rate would go down. Now, of course, it's tongue in cheek, but there's also something to it because these drugs are far safer than what's out there now. I mean,
That's
you'd have to
interesting.
take a whole handful of Vicodin to maybe die, but an eighth of a fentanyl pill with the wrong dose in it, and you're dead. So you tell me what's worse.
I think it's interesting when you talk about bureaucracies out of control, because we're starting to see that with the DEA now taking its own review of the rescheduling of marijuana. And I think that this is particularly important because the DEA is stating that they have ultimate authority under the Controlled Substance Act to determine the scheduling of drugs over the Department of Health and Human Services and other agencies. You alluded to this before when you talked about non-clinical folks kind of getting into the mix and putting their two cents into how these clinical and health policy decisions should be made. Is that an easy fix? Maybe bring in more clinicians, more health policy folks. Do you think that would help to some degree?
President and Congress willing to take this on. And it would be a very unpopular cause because it would basically be saying, okay, DEA, don't do your job so well. Not that doing it well, but don't do it so vigorously. And, the soundbite there is going to be awful. And Jeff Singer and I have written, since when do cops play doctor? I don't remember where we had that published, the Chicago Tribune or Philadelphia Inquirer, I think. Well, since when? Like, what kind of country is this? When you've got an agency full of maniacs that is dictating how much or what supply of opioid is allowed to be even manufactured, and that number goes down every single year, so there's shortages. And even worse, how much doctors are allowed to prescribe, because they're basing these arrests or persecutions on something you know very well called the morphine milligram equivalent. Mm-hmm. And you want to get me back on raving like a lunatic on that. It's a pharmacologically false, crappy, anti-scientific concept. And I've destroyed it in a number of articles.
Yeah.
The MME table is not only worthless, it's enormously damaging to doctors and patients. And you know this better than anyone. You can just take a number that doesn't mean anything and go 50 or 100% above it and just go after some poor guy who happens to have some bad patients that need more. And what's more galling is the number didn't mean anything in the first place. So, I mean, it sounds like Stalinist Russia.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, it really does. And, you know, that's why I'm so furious at these developments and how we're seeing lawyers, law firms, expert witnesses, and a bureaucracy driving a policy which is resulting in more deaths and more suffering.
Yeah. Election years.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
What could possibly be wrong with that policy?
So let's maybe transition that into the here and now. Election years tend to see a ramp up in the rhetoric. And talking about Stalinist communism, rhetoric and propaganda seems to be the calling card, particularly when you look at books like 1984. But you also see that in the here and now. How do you see election year shaping out in terms of rhetoric around these policies?
I don't believe I've heard a single word about the opioid crisis in any of the election stuff that I've been following. That doesn't mean it isn't there. I just haven't heard it. It does not seem to be a huge issue just based on my readings. Whereas, you know, what gender you want to identify with and things like this have taken this place. So unless you can tell me different, it seems to be like a dead topic.
It's interesting because when you look at the State of Union addresses, particularly when President Trump was in power, former President Trump was in power, you heard a lot about punishing the drug dealers, the opioid crisis, and it was almost on like peak front news for a certain number of years. And to your point, it's definitely not at that level of vigor. Would you think that's a good thing or a bad thing in terms of patient advocacy and trying to steer the ship the right way?
Well, it can't be worse. Well, it just can't be. You know, I'm sitting here worried about a relatively young woman with multiple spinal surgeries that I got friendly with over the phone. I never met her, but was helping me with my job. And I think she might be dead because she didn't get the kind of treatment that she wanted. So, like, this is somebody I got friendly with and talked to a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Like, that just makes me sick.
Yeah.
And you must know more of these than I do, and by a lot.
Yeah, it's the patient stories are galling, that is for sure.
Yeah. In fact, the last time I spoke to her, I didn't speak to her. It was a text a week ago. when she basically said she was going out onto the street. And, you know, I've texted and called and have never failed to get a response. And it's been a week and nothing. So it can't be good.
Wow. Yeah, it's tough. I'm actually interviewing a patient who is in a similar situation tomorrow. And what's so funny is that they keep coming. The patient stories just keep coming. And it's amazing how none of this has clicked in the minds of the politicians, legislators, that, hey, you know, maybe we're on a wrong path here, but just doesn't click. It is pretty emotional, that is for sure.
Probably taking up too much time, but in a country which is so filled with crazy conspiracies, there's actually a real conspiracy here. Right? You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That's these self-serving prop dirt bags working with the head of the CDC, Tom Friedman, for whatever his reasoning is, I don't know, for bringing Andrew Clavin to Washington with him, coming up with this plan to demonize and limit opioids. And the next thing you know, a bunch of these people who were in on these CDC meetings, which led to that disastrous 2016 so-called guidelines, which people are being thrown in jail, and they're making a fortune.
Yeah.
The DEA had, CDC had no business getting to this into this in the first place.
Yeah.
Why were these people in the room? What were they doing? What was the end game? Well, I think I damn well know what the end game was, and it's money.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you a question. Do you honestly believe for a second that Jane Ballantyne, Andrew Kolodny, Roger Chow, the collection of them really care whether anyone overdoses or not? Because I don't.
Yeah, it's difficult to look at their writings and not sense that they're conjecturing in a deliberately cynical manner. When they present the data in a way that's patient-centric, almost in a way to kind of give up the pretenses of being neutral, when you then read the results and discussion sections, you start to see, well, you're conjecturing quite a bit and you're introducing a lot of your own personal biases into this. And what's very interesting about the CDC guidelines is that it's almost like an atomic structure where everybody keeps focusing on the nucleus, but it's really the electron orbitals that determine the behavior. When you...
chemistry.
There you go. You know, I wanted to keep it on point. When you look at kind of what they talk about, the nuances, or recognize that these policies need to be personalized, it's always missed. It always distills down to, as you mentioned, an MME count or a certain recommendation that somehow becomes codified into law or a state stipulation through their state medical licensing board. I find it very hard to believe that that level of conjecture cannot be deliberate in nature.
There's zero chance.
Yeah.
It's not deliberate. And the more I'm in this, the more I'm convinced that this was planned in advance a long time ago with money and perhaps power, if you include the DEA, as the primary goals.
Yeah. I mean, you have to keep in mind the DEA is a self-funded institution. They don't have enough of annual revenue given through taxpayer dollars to be self-sufficient. So they do have a certain mandate to earn, either through civil asset forfeitures or other means, a certain level of financial remuneration to stay afloat. It's not hard to put these pieces together. It's interesting when you talk about the CDC, particularly in a post-COVID world, and all the conspiracy that came about with the CDC, and now you start to have certain folks from the NIH and CDC to come out saying, we might have been a little bit biased or one-sided in how we presented COVID policies, that we probably should have been more balanced, so on and so forth. But people were screaming left and right that there were ulterior motives, that they weren't taking all the details and science into account. That same logic, when you apply it to chronic pain patients or to addiction or to opioids in general, just falls on deaf ears. And it's very odd how just that transition in the same form of thinking, same form of misapplication of health policy in the same organization, CDC and NIH, when you apply it for one clinical condition, then to another clinical condition, the logic gets missed.
No one's ever going to be pro-opioid, but plenty of people will be anti-vaccine.
Yeah.
So it's just the nature of the topic is very different. There's one more thing I wanted to say. I'm no great fan of the CDC, but when it comes to the COVID, especially the early days, and don't forget, I worked in virology for 10 years, so I kind of know what I'm talking about. They did some things wrong in retrospect. Maybe they even did some things wrong, but we were looking at it like an end of the world kind of situation in the absence of these vaccines. And of course, they're going to get things wrong. There was research being done in a panic where they're looking at repurposed drugs, none of which worked, of course. And it was bedlam. I mean, these were frightening times.
Yeah.
And they're going to get things wrong. Early on, we talked about herd immunity. It was perfectly reasonable. Whether you're like Anthony Fauci or not, is perfectly reasonable to expect some kind of herd immunity. And then the thing started mutating like crazy, and then it became impossible. Well, not one person in the world would have expected these crazy variants, each one of which was more infective than the one before. No one. So, if somebody said that you're going to have some kind of a communal immunity, at the time, I agreed. It turned out to be wrong, but that was a legitimate, reasonable opinion, because this virus is like nothing we've ever seen in the world before.
Yeah,
nothing's ever done this. So, you know, they made mistakes. Maybe they weren't so honest all the time. But compared to what they've done with the opioids, you know, they were choir boys in the COVID years.
Mm-hmm. Is there, from your perspective, certain iterations made, certain ways by which they looked at the science, or at least internally deliberated upon converting science to policy, that worked well for COVID that you think should apply for opioids?
I think that you had millions of people around the world doing different things, testing different drugs, saying different things about the same virus. That's a recipe for a madhouse, which is just what it was. And then you have the president going on talking about bleach. And, well, let's just say that didn't help. So, you know, when there's a really frightening situation, and during the first few months, I've got asthma. I was terrified I was going to get it and die. Well, guess what? Now we know this, that, and the other thing. It doesn't have to be fatal, especially if you're vaccinated. But back in 2020, it was scary. And it would be impossible to have a coordinated effort around the world to get any kind of a unified response to it. So you had people testing ivermectin. It seemed to work. Well, it ended up not working, but it wasn't wrong to test it. They just, they kind of hung on to it a little too long. But I really can't fault anyone except just the anti-vaccine people, because, well, they can all just jump off the Grand Canyon for all I care. That's not a popular statement, is it?
Well, we're not really taking a popular stance on critical issues, even though we feel in the end we will be vindicated. And I think science has shown that whenever you take a patient-centric approach, you may not be right in the moment, but you prove to be right in the end. And I think that's what you and I both recognize.
I think they did pretty well under those circumstances.
Yeah. No, yeah. I agree as well. I think that the COVID response went through its iterations. And I think the strength of that whole era was their ability to navigate through cloudy waters and eventually get to the right point.
I mean, I'm certainly literate about virology and antiviral drugs. And some people that are real experts in the world were getting it wrong.
Yeah.
Because they never saw anything like this before. So you need to cut everybody a break there.
Yeah.
Except for the lunatics. And then, I don't think anybody's really paying much attention to them anymore.
Yeah. That's nice. On that note, Dr. Bloom, I want to conclude this by giving you an opportunity to let the audience know how they can get a hold of you and where they can read some of your future writing.
I guess I could give my email address. That's just what I need, more email. We only get 500 today now. It's just josh@scsh.org, which is American Council on Science and Health. And Twitter, I have a lot of followers. And what is it? Something really clever like @JoshBloomACSH. How I thought of that, I'll never know.
Truly original.
Yeah, there are a bunch of people that I use to spread the word, and an occasional obnoxious remark on that. Okay, more than occasional. But, if you write me, or you leave comments after my articles, I respond.
Yeah. So if that is one thing. You are definitely easy to get a hold of.
Yeah. Maybe a little too easy.
On that note, thank you so much for your time, Dr. Bloom.
And thank you very much. And you're really a great interviewer. I really enjoyed the hour.
Thank you.
Take care, Jay.
Take care.